I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this President's Day, the 17th of February. And we're going to talk about our first president this hour and what a state this country was in following the revolution. Oh, my goodness. Harlow Giles Unger has some stories to tell us this hour. Former Distinguished Visiting Fellow in American History at George Washington's Mount Vernon. He's the author of 20 books, including 6 biographies of the Founding Fathers, Patrick Henry and Lion of Liberty, James Monroe. I think that's the last time we talked to him was the James Monroe book. The Last Founding Father, John Quincy Adams, The Unexpected George Washington, His Private Life. And he's done other books as well. He was a journalist for a number of years, foreign correspondent, American affairs analyst for the New York Herald Tribune, overseas news service, The Times and Sunday Times of London, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He's also a professor of English and journalism. The name of the book is Mr. President George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Hello, Harlow. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me. It's an honor to be on your show.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And you, of all people, must really know how to celebrate President's Day.
Yes, and with lots and lots of wishes that he would come back to us.
I know. I had no idea until reading your book how the complete state of disarray this country was in after the revolution. I mean, it could have descended into civil war pretty easily.
Well, it eventually did, of course. But yes, you're absolutely right. The revolution created, and independence from England created, 13 independent countries.
Mm-hmm.
There was no unity. Each of these states were independent countries like Europe. And like Europe, they went to war with each other. They were battling each other over conflicting claims for territory. They were taxing each other's goods as they passed through. Goods from England on their way to New Jersey had to pay New York State duties. It was terrible, and the nation was on the verge of civil war when George Washington helped organize the Constitutional Convention, which he led. He became the presiding officer, the president of that convention, to tie the states together into a union with a federal government that would settle the disputes between the various states, control trade, control foreign trade, as well as trade between the states, and to raise a common defense in the event of attack by foreign nations. But the president himself, the Constitution gave the president himself very little power. It really created a figurehead. The framers had lived for many years under the tyranny of an absolute monarch, George III,
mm-hmm.
and they were not about to create a president who would have become a George IV.
Right.
So they put almost all the powers in the hands of the people. That's why the Constitution begins, "We the people." And the only body that the people actually elected directly was the House of Representatives. At the time, senators were appointed by state legislatures, and the president, of course, was elected by the Electoral College. So we, the people, had the most power. And as James Madison, who helped write the Constitution, put it, in our government, and these are Madison's words, in our government, the executive department is not the stronger branch of the system, but the weaker.
Mm-hmm.
And George Washington really started out under the Constitution as a figurehead. But what happened was that the Congress was out of session most of the year. They only met for about 6 weeks in the spring and 6 weeks in the fall, which left Washington alone to run the government most of the year. And he faced crises that the framers of the Constitution had not foreseen.
Mm-hmm.
And he had no choice but to take power into his own hands. And, for example, that first Congress adjourned in the fall of 1789, leaving the government without any money, and really forced a government shutdown, if you can imagine such a thing. That would never happen today, of course.
No, of course not.
uh, So there was Washington with no money to run the government, and he just took the law into his own hands and sent his Treasury Secretary to local banks in New York City to borrow money on his own say-so.
Mm-hmm. Well, to go back just a step, what's interesting is the war ends. He wants to. He goes home. He deserves a little bit of a rest, for heaven's sake. It's been quite a battle, and it was a hard war to fight. To spend some time with his grandchildren and with Martha. It almost makes you believe in destiny, because he was the only man, as you say in the book over and over again, who could unite, who was so honored, who was so admired, that perhaps he was the only one who could unite the country and do what he did.
He was the only one.
He was the only one.
Yeah, he had done so during the Revolution as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He was a Virginian, and there were more men in the army from the North than there were from the South. So he united the army, which was made up of men from all 13 colonies. He united them into one Continental Army. This amazing commander-in-chief who took a bunch of farmers and defeated the world's most powerful, best-equipped, best-trained army in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So he was an amazing man who people revered. And so when he retired, and he could have become dictator at the end of the war. He could have become a military dictator. But he believed in individual liberty. He believed in the principles that later became the principles of this country. And he wanted to go home to his farm, his beloved farm in Mount Vernon, which he then proceeded to build up into one of the nation's most prosperous agro-industrial enterprises. In the United States, he built Mount Vernon into an amazing enterprise with vast fields of grain and tobacco, a fishery, a grist mill, a distillery. It was a huge business enterprise that he loved running. He loved farming. He loved planting. He became one of the world's great industrial agricultural scientists. He wrote learned papers for agricultural scientific journals in Europe. He was the developer of crop rotation. He invented grafting a century before Luther Burbank. Burbank gets all the credit, but Washington developed grapes that now still grow in and produce wine in Virginia. He was the developer of the dwarf fruit trees. The fruit trees that were easier to harvest.
Mm-hmm.
He developed growing fruit trees as in espalier form, a flat form of tree that grew against brick walls that faced the sun and emitted heat, so it allowed them to grow for longer periods of the year and produce two instead of a single crop. He was an amazing, brilliant man and a brilliant leader, a great chief executive, both in peace and in war.
Mm-hmm. I love the story you tell in the book of the gathering in Congress of what are we going to call this new position. Are we going to call it? Well, tell us what they all suggested before they came up with the president.
That's why I call my book Mr. President in quotes, because he was the first elected president in history.
Mm-hmm.
There had never been such.
Isn't that amazing what you just said? The first elected president in history.
In the world history, yeah.
Right.
So they didn't know what to call him. The only titles they knew were titles of aristocrats and kings and emperors, and so some suggested calling him His Elective Highness. There were all sorts of silly aristocratic names until James Madison finally reminded everybody that the Constitution, the new Constitution, prohibited the use of titles and aristocratic titles in the United States, and that the president was a citizen like everyone else and should be addressed as such, Mr. And so he became Mr. President, and that's how the title originated. And he got into trouble almost immediately because he went to the Senate. Mr. President Washington went to the Senate with a draft of a treaty that his Secretary of War had negotiated with the Indians out west. And once in the Senate, The presiding officer of the Senate, of course, is the vice president, but as presiding officer in the Senate, he is addressed as Mr. President. So here was Mr. President Washington entering the Senate, faced with the prospects of addressing his own vice president, John Adams, as Mr. President.
As Mr. President. Oh, my goodness.
And Washington was not going to address anyone as Mr. President. So he resolved the problem in his own particular way, inimitable way. He walked out and never set foot in the Senate again, nor has any other president ever gone to address the Senate. Since then, every president has addressed only a joint session of Congress.
Oh, fascinating.
And only in the House of Representatives, where the presiding officer is addressed as Mr. Speaker.
Oh.
And only the President of the United States is addressed as Mr. President.
Oh, the precedent he set on so many levels, huh? Just a sideline, because I found so many of your stories, you really know your history. Maybe it's a perception that John Adams and George Washington didn't get along very well, but you talk about the fact that they were kind of friendly. They talked about their farms. They were
very friendly. It was John Adams, after all, who proposed George Washington as commander-in-chief at the Continental Congress. He realized that, you know, the Minutemen of Massachusetts had already surrounded the British Army. They were already at war with the British and had surrounded the British Army in Boston. That's why Patrick Henry said, "Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle?" And call the nation to war to support the people of Massachusetts. But the Southerners were afraid that if Congress supported the Massachusetts Army, what was to prevent Massachusetts from trying to conquer the rest of the United States, just like the British had done? Well, John Adams was from Massachusetts, and he got to know the people at the Continental Congress. And there was only one American-born member of Congress with any military experience. That was George Washington of Virginia. So he made a point of getting to know Washington, and they went to church together. They would have dinner together, and they became very good friends. They were both farmers, so they had that in common. They both loved farming. Actually, Washington was curious how Adams made a living off his 40-acre farm. And Adams was curious how Washington managed a 20,000-acre farm.
Whoa, what a difference.
So they had a lot to talk about, became good friends, and finally John Adams proposed Washington as commander-in-chief, and that's why the southern states joined the Revolution and contributed troops to the Continental Army. And he remained the only person that could unite North and South. As Jefferson put it when he was trying to convince Washington to serve a second term as president, he said, "North and South will hang together if they have you to hang on."
Oh, my. What a burden on him. Let's welcome phone calls. Here's how you reach our President's Day conversation about George Washington with the author of the highly readable. Harlow is a wonderful writer. It's not dull history. It's really exciting, and it's amazing how important it was for George Washington to be the first president of the country, because he outlined so vividly what was going on in these separate states. Harlow Giles Unger is the author of Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Actually, it was a John Quincy Adams book that we interviewed him for. I forgot about that one, which is a terrific book. That was our last interview with Harlow. So here's our phone number as we talk about George Washington. Here is how you can let us know your thoughts or ask your questions of this wonderful historian. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, aren't we modern? And that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Harlow Giles Unger, author of Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. We start our calls with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, sir.
I understand that President Washington composed an inaugural address with an aide of his, maybe at Mount Vernon, but that initial inaugural address that he prepared was never delivered. He apparently thought better of it. And I wonder if Dr. Unger can talk about that lost address, parts of which I believe have been reconstructed, and discuss a little bit the political philosophy that President Washington expressed in that undelivered speech.
Thanks, Bill.
There were very few ideas in that speech. One of the reasons he did not deliver the speech was that he had a terrible problem with his false teeth at the time. He had only one tooth left when he took his oath of presidency. And false teeth were not as well developed in those days. They were held together with wires. You had to have a special pair of pliers, and you'd tighten them up when you tried to eat, and you'd loosen them. And there's very little. That first speech was really of no consequence. The great speech that he delivered in the course of his 8 years was his farewell address to the nation, in which he pleaded with the nation not to dissolve into political parties, to remain united as one people, and not to form political parties. Thomas Jefferson was already trying to form a political party, and Washington, who had fired Jefferson as Secretary of State, begged the American people not to fall prey to political parties, to think of national unity at all times. And he pleaded with his successors not to get involved in foreign wars or to form foreign alliances. Mm-hmm. He pleaded with them to trade with everybody, but not to get involved in alliances, because that an alliance with a foreign nation cedes to that foreign nation some control over our liberties. We then are tied to the whims and caprices of a foreign nation, and that was against his principles. He wanted us to remain independent, uniquely American, and united as a people.
Hmm. Well, nobody listened to that very carefully, did they?
Well, I think they listened, but they get involved in selfish programs for their own benefits. Washington was unique as president of the United States because he never did anything for political purposes. He always did everything motivated by sheer patriotism and love of this country.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was probably only one other president who acted in the same way. That was Dwight Eisenhower.
Thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Gail in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I would like to ask Dr. Unger about Lafayette. And I don't think, like, a lot of my friends never heard of him or are even really aware of what the French did to help us. And I, of course, read Dr. Unger's book, Lafayette, is quite the tearjerker, and I'm just wondering why he isn't more prominent in our telling of the Founding Fathers.
All right. Thanks, Gail.
Well, I disagree with you with all due respect. Certainly he's very prominent in the history we study, that I studied as I grew up, and when people study American history today, I think there are more than 500 towns across the country that are named after Lafayette. So I would disagree that he's ignored. I think he gets tremendous coverage in the study of American history, and as do the French for sending the French army. I think everybody knows that the French fleet sailed in at Yorktown and prevented the British troops under Cornwallis from escaping. Yorktown's on a peninsula that sticks out into Chesapeake Bay, and there was no way for them to escape when Washington and Washington's forces approached the British camp, because the French fleet had sailed in. So along the East Coast, there are certainly many signs and indications of where Rochambeau led the French army down from Massachusetts all the way down to Yorktown. So I think Lafayette gets pretty good recognition, and those who don't know about him can read my book, Lafayette.
Absolutely, which is a tearjerker, Gail said. I want to talk just a moment before we go back to phone calls about the broader vision that Washington had. You write that when he stepped off center stage of public life at the end of 1783, then his concerns mounted over the disorders that were engulfing the nation. The freedom engendered by independence from Britain had failed to produce the utopian republic that Washington had envisioned. What was that utopian republic?
Well, he thought we would all unite as we had in the war. He had united the Continental Army forces from all the states, and he had hoped that Americans would be, because remember, 95% of Americans were farmers then, so that he felt that this common interest, this common occupational pursuit would unite us all as a people, but it didn't. Each of the states became an independent country. We were like Europe, and the 13 states basically went to war with each other and just refused to cooperate with each other. Washington had to pull them together at the Constitutional Convention and create the new nation. But even after he succeeded doing that, the Constitution gave him so little power that the nation was threatened with a breakdown of order thereafter. And he had to seize powers, unconstitutional powers. In my book, I describe how he seized powers in seven different areas. I call them the seven pillars of executive power that created what modern scholars call the imperial presidency, because the president, in many respects, has the powers of an absolute ruler, of an emperor. Even James Madison called Washington's presidency the monarchical presidency, because he seized powers of a king in many areas. As I've already described, how he borrowed money on his own. He sent troops to war on his own without the congressional consent. He has no constitutional powers to send troops to war. He issued the first presidential proclamation with the force of law. And nothing in the Constitution gives the president the power to issue a proclamation or an executive order with the force of law. That's why the Congress is called the legislature. And yet Washington did so. And in doing so, created precedents that his successors have often used wisely, but have often used recklessly. President Lincoln used the power of proclamation to issue the Emancipation Proclamation that ended slavery. President George W. Bush and President Obama have used that power to give the NSA the right to spy on every American.
Right.
So some presidents have used these powers recklessly, and some have used them very wisely.
Why is it that Washington didn't say, hey, wait a second, guys, we got a good start here, but I need to call you back because we need to define, all of us, what the presidential powers should be? Why did he take it upon himself to do it himself?
Because you can't do that in a democracy. One thing he realized, even after signing, and he was the first to sign the Constitution, he said, this is not a perfect document. This is a compromise, and that the interests of one, this a nation of varying interests, wide-ranging interests, and when you satisfy the interests of one person, you necessarily deprive someone else of their interests. It's impossible to satisfy everybody in a free society if we are to remain free. As Alexander Hamilton put it, if you want an efficient government, get a dictator. This is a democracy with wide-ranging, conflicting interests. A snowfall is considered a horrible event here in New York City. In Vail, Colorado, it's an economic boom. Skiers flock there because of the snow. So people today who criticize Congress and the government as being dysfunctional. Well, that's exactly what the framers intended. It's people only say the government's only dysfunctional when it doesn't do what I want it to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful government when it does what I want it to do.
Yeah.
And in a society of as large as ours, with so many conflicting interests, it's impossible to satisfy everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets a little, but nobody gets everything they want.
Right.
And this is what compromise is about. This is what living in a free society is about. There is no solution to huge social problems that affect everyone. The problem affects everybody, but the solutions cannot satisfy everybody.
Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Dr. Unger, I'm finding this conversation entirely charming on a very snowy day here in Wisconsin. Everything from our orthodontically challenged first chief executive officer to the many things you're saying. And it also gives me perspective on why we should cut some slack to the Egyptians as they struggle to define what direction their country is going to take. But my question is, comment and your reaction to it is, I've always thought it a great gift of fate for this fledgling democracy that George Washington had no biological children of his own, no heir apparent successor from his bloodline was available, that the next officers of the country would have to come from the other citizens of the country. And I'm wondering if you've reflected on that moving against monarchy, but with still so many associations with how monarchy worked, the American colonists might have been tempted to consider some line of succession in government.
Hmm. Harlow.
Yeah, actually, they never were, because the country was so divided. The 13 states, remember, were not just divided by frontiers; they were divided by lack of communication and a lack of transportation. It took 6 days to get from Boston to New York. There were just dirt roads and trails; you couldn't travel. There was no mass communication, maybe a dozen newspapers across the country, and it would take 6 weeks before news would get into print, and then distribution was sparse indeed. When that first Continental Congress met, people from the South couldn't understand people from the North and vice versa. They did not understand what they were saying.
Oh, my.
Accents were so different.
Oh.
Everybody thinks we spoke English. We didn't. We had we had Dutch in the Hudson Valley. We had Swedes in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
We had French in Vermont. There were at least Germans all over the area of eastern Pennsylvania. There's one town outside of Philadelphia that's called Germantown. And Benjamin Franklin complained in the 1750s, if we don't force these people to speak English, we're going to have to learn German. He was furious that that no one could understand him when he crossed the Philadelphia borders into Germantown area. So there were terrible problems of communication and no thought of anyone becoming leader of the entire nation. It was the British who overreacted to tax protests and sent troops into Boston to try to put down those protests. And in doing so, created what today we'd call a humanitarian disaster by threatening to starve the people of Boston until they paid back to the East India Tea Company the cost of the tea dumped overboard in the Boston Harbor. The troops, British Army just overreacted. They never should have sent troops into Boston. They never should have declared martial law. In doing so, that rallied the people of Massachusetts. They formed their militia and surrounded Boston and surrounded the British Army in Boston. That aroused Patrick Henry and the Virginians to rally the rest of the nation, with Patrick Henry calling for us all to fight for liberty or death. And there we went off to the races in the revolution.
Yeah.
But it was an overreaction by the British Army that started this thing. And even after the revolution began, one-third of the people lived in what would become the United States were still loyal to the British crown, mm-hmm. and to the British flag. Over a half million loyalists fled their homes, were forced to flee because of the revolution. This was not a universally popular revolution, and certainly there was no thought of a federal government at that time.
Right. Thanks, Rich, very much for your call, as always. Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I was... One of my favorite movies to watch, we always watch it on the 4th of July, is 1776.
Uh-huh.
It's really a delightful musical, and it depicts these different people involved with the, our independence. And typically, Ben Franklin is always depicted as a fun-loving, jolly, jokester. And Washington went through all of this hardship, again, according to the story. I often wonder... Very often, humor comes out of hardship. And is there any evidence that Washington had developed a sense of humor after all he went through?
Well, he had a tremendous sense of humor. He was a tremendous man, a very warm, loving. You should get my book, The Unexpected George Washington, which describes his private life. That's never been done before. But he was a very warm, loving man with a great sense of humor. And I enjoyed 1776 on stage here in New York when it was a Broadway musical. But it is a musical. It is not history. It is, if you want history, read history books. If you want amusement, go see 1776, because Washington was not at the Continental Congress in 1776. He was up in Massachusetts fighting the war. We had been at war since 1775, a year earlier. It was a year later that Congress finally declared independence.
You talk about, just to give, in some of his private life and who he was is in this book. I haven't read your other book on Washington, but I will. Sense of humor, but also the things that he had studied, which I found interesting. He'd studied crown law, criminal law, libel laws. What else had he studied? What was he expert on?
He was one of the most brilliant men in American history, certainly.
Really?
On a par with Benjamin Franklin. Unlike Jefferson, he never went to college, but he had a library as big as Jefferson's. He was self-taught, like Benjamin Franklin. From the age of 12, he read and read, built up this huge library. He studied economics, he studied military science, he studied agriculture, studied literature, studied every area you would on the way to a PhD. And we know that he studied all these books because those that have survived and can be viewed at the new Presidential Library at Mount Vernon, George Washington Library, there are his notes in the margins. So we know he read these things. He didn't just collect books.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a great economist, a great political scientist. He studied history. He read Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He studied Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. He was a brilliant, brilliant man, and is not given much credit.
No, he's not. No, he's not.
He's really pictured as a stern-faced general,
mm-hmm.
and he was so much more than that. He raised his Martha Washington was a widow when he married her, with two baby children, and he raised them as his own. And the letter from Jackie, his stepson, to Washington when he feared Washington was about to die or in battle at the Battle of New York, at Battle of Manhattan, is one of the most tender letters from a son to a father you ever read. It just draws tears to your eyes. And when his stepdaughter, Nellie, when her husband died, and he pleads with her to come with the four children to live at Mount Vernon, where that Martha and he can look after them all and help her through her grief. It's just absolutely the warmest kind of man you could possibly.
Harlow Giles Unger is our guest this hour, and the man he's talking about is George Washington. Professor Unger's latest book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, a perfect way for us to celebrate this President's Day. Our phone number, Jack, thanks for your call. We have one line open, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. You can always leave messages. We're asking people on this President's Day to list your presidents you think are the most effective and why you think that. It's a perfect day for you to leave that kind of message. And we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Harlow Giles Unger, author most recently of Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Harlow is a journalist, a broadcaster, educator. He is the former Distinguished Visiting Fellow in American History at Mount Vernon. Sarah in Zion, hi.
Great, hi. You know, it just occurred to me while you were talking that although it's a democracy, I'm pretty sure it was only land-owning white males who were allowed to vote. And I wonder if the guest knows if the reason the Founding Fathers made it that way was because they really just thought only those people were smart enough and informed enough to cast a vote, or if they really wanted to keep power out of the hands of the riffraff because that would upset the power status quo.
I think you'd have to poll each of the Founding Fathers to find out his particular motives. But in broadest terms, of course, women were property, so there was no question about their having anything to say. The nation was divided on the question of slavery. And the reason the Constitution was written as it was again, as Washington put it, a compromise. The only way the South would join the Union was if the Constitution ignored slavery and just left things alone, maintained the status quo. Everything in the Constitution was a compromise. For every interest group, there was an opposite interest group. The large states, there were three large states, Massachusetts, Virginia was the largest state in terms of population. Virginia, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania were the three largest states. And they wanted proportionate representation, as in the House of Representatives, based on population. But the small states said, well, these three states with the majority of the population, they can control all 13. So they wanted to maintain one state, one vote, as it had been in the Confederation Congress and in the Continental Congress. So each state had one vote. Well, now the three biggest states, hey, we have 90% of the population, and all of you smaller states with 10%, you're going to control us? We won't allow that. So that was they compromised the Senate. The states had an equal. Each state had the same number of votes, two votes apiece. And in the House of Representatives, it was based on population. It was a compromise. Everything was a compromise. It doesn't work perfectly, but it's the best that could be done to keep the Union together. That was Washington's goal all of his life, to keep the Union together.
You mentioned that in South Carolina, and I'm wondering if this varied from state to state, that they set very high property qualifications for voting and for holding office, requiring assets in today's money of $750,000 to vote or stand for election. Was that an extreme, or did other states have similar kinds of requirements?
It varied from state to state. In South Carolina, you had an oligarchy running the state when it was a colony, and they wanted to maintain power. These were the huge, huge landowners that owned these gargantuan plantations, controlled enormous numbers of slaves, and kept the white workers under their thumbs. So they wanted to retain power. But you had a similar situation in Pennsylvania, where a small group of bankers in Philadelphia controlled much of the wealth of the state, and they wanted to retain power there. So those in power before independence wanted to stay in power after independence, and they worked hard at the Constitutional Convention to write a constitution whereby they would retain power while ceding some power to the people who had fought in the Revolutionary War. But it was a knockdown, drag-out battle, and the result, as I say, was a compromise that satisfied nobody. But on the other hand, it allowed the Union to survive, and that was the important thing. And even during his presidency, the Union was constantly faced with a fracture. The Anglo-French War, France declared war on Britain in 1793, and that war tore the American people apart. Both the French and English were seizing our ships to prevent cargoes from America reaching enemy ports. Half the Americans were on the side of the French and half were on the side of the English, and there were riots in the streets. John Adams described the rioting in the temporary capital of Philadelphia. 10,000 people on the streets,
oh my,
threatening to drag Washington out of his house and hang him on the gallows.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he declared the first presidential proclamation. It was called the Neutrality Proclamation, with the force of law that prohibited Americans from taking sides in the Anglo-French War. And that was the first presidential executive order in history. It ended the rioting. And then later on, he drafted troops to produce a federal police force, in effect.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. I still am wondering, would President Washington be a Republican or what?
He would be neither. He hated, despised political parties. He pleaded with the American people not to form political parties, to remain united as one people. In his farewell address, he emphasized because Jefferson was starting a political party at the time, and he pleaded with the American people to reject the idea of political parties and remain united as one people.
Thanks, Kenneth. Carol in Appleton. Hi.
Good afternoon. I've been listening to this conversation, and the major thing that I find missing is that any discussion of Washington's career, the success of Mount Vernon, the things he accomplished, we have to recognize that he was able to do all these things because he exploited slave labor and the indigenous population. And we need to recognize those unnamed souls who built Mount Vernon, who provided his fortune. Of course, they came to his marriage from Mary.
Do you have a question, or are you making a speech?
I'm sorry, sir?
Well, can you comment on what she had to say, the way he treated
slaves?
Do you have
slaves? A question there?
No, can you comment on how he treated slaves?
He was one of the most forward-looking men in America in terms of slavery. From the very beginning, he wanted to end slavery. Virginia law banned the emancipation of slaves. So what he did with Martha, by the way. She was a great influence there. He began training all of his slaves. He never bought and sold slaves. He inherited these slaves. You know, slavery was already there when the Founding Fathers were born. They didn't invent it. Indeed, at the beginning of the 18th century, Virginia's leaders voted to end slavery, and good Queen Anne rejected that ban because the British Crown depended on the slave trade. Washington started a program of training all his slaves. By the time the Revolutionary War was over, he had no white overseers. All of the former slaves were overseers on his plantation. And in his will, because that was allowed, in his will he freed all the slaves and provided for them to stay and live at the plantation as long as they wanted to, or leave whenever they wanted to. But they all learned trades, and Martha taught the girls all of the trades that would be useful in pursuing careers after their death.
Thank you, Carol, very much for your call. George in Mazamani. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, George. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering, this was the age of the Enlightenment, and I wondered, I think George Washington, you can correct me on this, was a deist, and many of his fellow thinkers were deists. And I'm wondering how that influenced their decisions in the Congress and afterwards of building the country, that the Age of Enlightenment and this whole deist point of view had any impact on him.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by a deist. Washington was an Anglican. And as were most people in Virginia, we had different religions all across the country. There were in the Northeast, they were what we now call Congregationalists. Historically, they called Puritans, but they're now called Congregationalists. The Episcopals were Anglicans at the time. With independence, they rejected Anglicanism because they rejected the king as the head of the church. So it became the Episcopal Church, and that divided into High Episcopal and Low Episcopal. The Baptists now came into the South, and so they were not deists. Washington went to church regularly. He was, the church was itself divided and falling apart because of the loss of the king and the Archbishop of Canterbury as their nominal leaders. So this left everything kind of up in the air. John Adams was a Congregationalist. He went to church regularly. Jefferson was probably the only person that you could call a deist in the sense that he wasn't a regular churchgoer, but still believed in a higher power. Washington never used the words God or Christ in his speeches because he recognized the diversity of the American people, and he spoke largely of a higher power or providence. This was not so much a reflection of it was a reflection of his own beliefs, but it wasn't his lack of religious affiliation. It was his respect for the diversity of the American population.
Mm-hmm. Harlow Giles Unger, happy President's Day, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always an honor to be on your show.
The book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow during this hour, Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. Our guest, Dr. Kevin Fong, will profile really courageous individuals who pushed the limits of physiology and medicine and led to all kinds of breakthroughs in open heart surgery, skin grafting, intensive care, underwater and outer space exploration. He's worked with NASA, practiced extreme medicine himself, treating victims at the scene of the London bombing in April of 1999 and working as a scuba medic off the coast of Fiji. So that's coming up for the second hour of our program tomorrow, which is the day after President's Day. So, let's carry on and read more about the presidents. You can rest assured that we will do many more shows on many more presidents.